So this is an interesting text, is it not? This is a little bit different. This is an interesting text in one sense because this is the very only text in the entire Pentateuch that these first five books actually request that you memorize, that the people memorize. And this song is still one of those texts that Jews is very, very important for them to memorize. And it's a little bit difficult at times, right? There's some interesting things in here. It's a little bit hard to understand. But I'm going to try to put it in a certain type of context. It's not going to really fill out the entire picture because you could spend lots of time on the song. But I'm just going to kind of focus in on one or two basic things about the song. Now, I was recently listening to a psychologist named Jonathan Haidt discuss a basic principle in political thinking for both right and the left. This is a guy who's he's a moral psychologist. He has a new book out which is trying to understand why the two sides don't understand each other. He pointed out that all political persuasions create sacredness or sacred cows or taboos. And around those sacred things, those sacred issues, you'll find what he called a ring of motivated ignorance. What he means by motivated ignorance is that people basically find ways to deny facts that don't sit well with what they find sacred. So his examples, I'll give two examples that he gave. He's himself, by the way, very, very liberal. Part of the reason why he wrote this book is to help liberals understand conservatives, because he actually likes conservatives. But one of the examples he used was liberals' desire not to stigmatize anybody. For instance, they don't want to stigmatize people who are parts of non-traditional families, where the biological father is absent and someone who's non-biological is the father, stepfather type situation. But according to research that he and mothers have done, mothers' boyfriends are some of the most dangerous people that a child can be in contact with. Instances of sexual abuse happen way more frequently in non-biological fathers, and other types of abuse happen way more frequently. So liberals have kind of a motivated ignorance about that issue. On the other side, right now, he talks about conservatives and tax cuts and some of the sacredness around that particular issue and how that ignores plenty of research that tax cuts don't do what the right wants them to do. And so his idea here is basically that there's certain issues that really push out facts from people's minds. That it's such an important issue, you don't want to hear things that might contradict it. And of course, this is nothing new. And this is a new way to say a very old truth that all of us know about. People make sacred cows about lots of different things. And we know that. It's kind of one of those things that it's very easy to criticize other people's sacred cows, right? And you can see where they're kind of being ignorant on purpose. But the question is, why do we do this? And of course, another question is, should we do this? Do we need to do this? So tonight we're going to look at this song, and it actually has something to say about this particular issue. And it brings out one of the central truths of our faith, and the central practices of our faith. My sermon title is Learning to Confess, because it brings out a very central truth. God is our only source, and confession is one of the basic ways we learn that God is our only source of life. So my first point, what I'm going to do, is I'm going to discuss the anatomy of a sacred cow. I was thinking to myself that I really wish I could have had a picture of Troy McClure and a little cow. Everybody knows Troy McClure? Simpsons fans here? No one? Troy McClure? My name is Troy McClure? All right, never mind. I thought there might be some Simpsons fans here, but apparently there's not. Anyway, that fell flat. There are three parts to a sacred cow. Go ahead. First, sacred cows create boundaries. And when I say sacred cow, I mean a sacred thing. An essential function of a sacred cow is to create divisions or boundaries that help identify who's in and who's out. So I'm going to talk about the issue of the so-called worship wars. Now, our church doesn't really have worship wars comparatively to how it's been in other places. So when I say any of this, this is not implicating anybody here, by the way. Now, in the so-called worship wars, especially happened in the 80s a lot, there were traditionalists who saw hymns and the organ as sacred, and that, in a way, served to shore up a certain identity. If you were in one of those traditional churches back in the 80s that did this, you were seen on the side of orthodoxy, as it were, right thinking. And those who were a part of the Jesus movement back in the 70s and 80s, who were really trying to get, you know, kind of a new way of thinking, their sacred cow was to see something about their identity surrounded around something new and fresh and spontaneous. And both sides saw this particular thing as sacred, their particular musical way of thinking as sacred. And so they were very, very good at sifting out people, separating people, so you know who was in and who was out in your group. Now, the second part of a sacred cow is fear. When we make a thing sacred, it sort of creates fear because we don't want to destroy the thing by desecrating it. And it allows us to deal with our fears. This is a very interesting function of sacred cows. In other words, it kind of gives us a set of rules that protect a sacred thing, because we develop all these rules around this sacred thing, and we come to believe that that sacred thing, if we lost it, it would be a real threat to our lives. And so it kind of creates a real fear for us. So if we go back to the worship war, the traditionalists saw the loss of church tradition as the reason for the decline of the church. While others, on the other side, thought the inability to adapt as the reason for the church decline. Now, both sides find a convenient target for what they fear. And what they fear is the fact that Christianity has lost its kind of cultural influence and starting to decline. And, of course, this focusing on this particular issue makes the fear a lot worse as well. So sacred things kind of heighten fear as well as create fear and help you to deal with fear, because it's something you can pin your fears on. The third part of a sacred cow is that it's the supposed life-giving energy or life-giving source of things. The things that we make sacred are the things that we believe are the source of life for us. This is why we're afraid when they're threatened, right? And why we separate people based on them. So traditionalists see the source of life for churches as their traditions of church, as their roots, especially the church they grew up with, while the other side sees the source of life as adapting to new circumstances. Now, this is not to say either of their arguments are wrong, but when you start making sacred cows, it changes the game a lot. Now, these two issues are very, very benign in this grand scope of things. In Germany, in the 1930s, sacred cows were an unmitigated disaster. The German people, the national spirit, became a sacred cow. An idea about the national German character which helped explain the decline of Germany and all the fear that that produced, and figured out ways to deal with that fear, right? To get rid of the polluted element, the Jews. And by the way, I should mention that these three parts of a sacred cow were three functions that temples fulfilled in the ancient world. These three things were very much, the temples in the ancient world were really much about these three particular issues. They were places where the difference between human and divine, the lines, the boundaries that separated human and divine, was displayed. It was a place where the differences between humans in terms of a priestly class, a political class, and the common people were displayed. It's a place where threats could be dealt with, fears. You can purge a temple if demons have been there. If there's a disaster in your land, you could sacrifice something. And it was the place where the source of life was thought to be. The God himself, who was the source of life for a nation, thought to reside in a temple. So it's very interesting how, when we talk about sacred things, in the ancient world, it was very concentrated in one place, where now it's a little bit more diffused. And so what are the effects of these three things? The basic effect of these three things is that they enslave us. This is the biggest issue with sacred cows. If you make an issue into a sacred cow, you are going to be enslaved by that particular issue. We call them idols back in the ancient world, or sacred cows now. Both of them enslave us to them. And this is where the Song of Moses comes in. So, my second point is that we're going to basically do a reading of this Song of Moses, and I'm going to talk about this song as a song of confession. So on the handout I've given you, there's numbers. So why don't you actually look at it, and I'll kind of give you a little reading of this as kind of a poem. Now each number gives a portion of scripture, and they're kind of together in a certain logic. It begins with an introduction to the entire song, and it's styled in what's called a reeb, or a covenantal lawsuit. When you hear this thing that says witnesses of heaven and earth being called as witnesses, this is something that covenants do. They call certain witnesses to people. And so this type of writing is very, very common to the prophets. You'll read this a lot in the prophets. And it really, basically, the idea is it accuses Israel somehow of disloyalties to the covenant, and then proceeds, like a lawyer, to lay out the case. So right from the beginning, we get to see what this is all about. The second section begins with the actual indictment. And it does so in a way that will be pretty consistent throughout the song. It contrasts in a very clever way, actually, and I like Eugene Peterson's translation here, two different ways. Oh. It contrasts a way between the rock, God, who is steadfast, the straight arrow God, as Peterson has a translation, which is kind of a good translation. It evokes the images of an order, like a straight wall or a fence. And then it contrasts this with the Israelites, who are messed up, mixed up children, children who are not steadfast and constant, but are like the sand, and they're also crooked rather than straight. So these children are acting without any reverence for God who created them, and this is the problem. So this song continues in section 3 with a call to remember the mighty acts of God. Now, this song was probably done originally as a liturgy. So you hear all these different voices here. And one scholar thinks that probably this would have been sung by something like a choir master, calling this out to the congregation. And so this song is basically calling to the congregation to remember the mighty acts of God. And then the fourth section actually discusses the beginnings of Israel and God's mighty acts. Now, one of the very interesting things here is how this connects the salvation or the call of Israel as a people out of Egypt with creation. Listen to the creation language in this. This is a cosmic view of things. God, who created the nations, who chose Israel out of the nations, so thus not only is salvation amazing, not only does God take up the Israelites like an eagle, this image of an eagle taking up their young and helping them to fly, or miraculously feeding Israel out of the flinty rock, but God, from the foundation of the world, as it were, chooses Israel. And this makes sections 5 and 6 all the more stark. God gave Israel the fat of the land, meaning the best of the land, but Israel became fat themselves and forgot God. And instead of remembering that the fat of the land had its source in this God, they started sacrificing to demons and claiming that other gods gave it to them, gods who were really no gods. And so the God who was their father and their mother, the rock who bore them, is overthrown for idols, or whatever is on the sacred market at the particular time. And so the consequence in section 7 is a God who turns his back on Israel, and instead of being the source of life, becomes the source of death for Israel. Just as they goad him with a no God, he will goad them with a no people, which is a term that's applied to nomads without a nation, kind of roving bands of nomads. So presumably they'll come after the Israelites, and there'll be other disasters, this kind of terrible list, kind of really blood-curdling list of disasters. So in other words, God is saying, you've made your bed, now lie in it. Yet section 8 and 9 show that God will not follow through with this. He could, but the problem is then those people, those what the translation here is ninnies, which I don't know when that term was current. Yeah, I don't know what we use now, but I could think of a couple words. Julie likes names. But speaking to these nations, they'll think that they've destroyed Israel because of their own strength. That's the issue. Now God is worried. They would think that their rock, and this their rock refers to their gods, were the reason for the victory, not the true rock or the true God. And that would defeat the entire purpose of God entering into a covenant with Israel, which is so that Israel is a priestly nation that shows the identity of God. So in other words, if he allowed the nations to destroy Israel, the nations wouldn't realize who was actually doing it. They wouldn't realize it's the true God doing it, because Israel was supposed to show the true God to the nations, and they're the ones being destroyed. And as section 9 shows, it is really God who has the power over everything that nations do anyway. Using the divine warrior language, which we've heard many times before, God describes the type of warrior he is. He's concerned with the poor and the needy, and ready to destroy those who feast on the fat of their offerings to gods who are not gods. Again, that fat terminology. And then speaking once more to the Israelites, section 10 brings this all to a head. Do you see it now? Do you see that I'm the one? I bring death and I give life. I wound and I heal. In other words, while the Israelites made the mistake of thinking other gods gave to them, as did the nations, he now admonishes them to realize that it is only God who does this. God has the sole authority to judge, the sole power to give life or death. And that's why the song ends as it does in section 11, with a call for the nations to celebrate. This God who has power over life and death is a God who is just, who protects those who are harmed and purges the land for the people, meaning that he is faithful to the covenant as he sets out. In other words, after this entire thing, Israel sinned. He did not actually destroy them. He actually protected them. And now you can see why in section 12, Moses tells the Israelites to memorize this. They'll get it into their heart. This encapsulates a lot about who God is. And so my third point is about what this song does for us in practice. Confession is learning to live life without the sacred. Now, sacred cows, sorry. Thank you. Without sacred cows. There you go. The first thing, there's kind of a couple implications here, but the first thing I want to kind of talk about is the context of this song. Now, the song is placed in Deuteronomy just after Moses' speech giving the law. So that Deuteronomy is kind of the second giving of the law. Moses has this long, long speech about, you know, the law. And just before Moses dies, just before they enter the promised land. It's a song really about the future, since the people actually have not done this, all this bad stuff yet. They haven't gotten the fat of the land because they haven't been in the land. All right, so this is the predictive element in this is the fact that for 40 years they've been disobedient, right? And so he's expecting them to do this. So what Moses wants them to do is memorize this song, to get it in their bones and to sing it. And as I said, a lot of scholars think that this song may have been an entire liturgy that was sung in the temple. And this one of the basic reasons, if you look at this and you read it again, take it home and read it, you'll notice there's a lot of changes of voices. Sometimes God is speaking, sometimes some other person is speaking, and then another person is speaking. There's at least three voices in here. It gets very confusing. And so they think it may have been, like other psalms are used in liturgies in the temple, this may have actually been a song that was like a liturgy. Now think about that fact for a moment. Can you actually imagine ourselves on a Friday night singing this entire song? I mean, think about that for a moment. Like, we don't have any songs that are this harsh to ourselves. Think about singing that accusation about you being a tub of lard, about getting fat off the fat of the land God has given you. Imagine singing those parts about God destroying you because of your disloyalty. The message would be clearly would be that you acknowledge what you acknowledge as sacred might not actually be sacred. What you use to create boundaries, to allay your fears, and to acknowledge that the source of your life might not be. This song, in other words, introduces uncertainty into the sacred cows that we create. But of course, that's not all. The song doesn't just leave us hanging with this uncertainty. The most important statement in the entire song comes in section 10. I bring death and I give life. I wound and I heal. A more literal translation would be, I kill and I give life. This is an essential statement because it contrasts this God with the sacred cows that we make. So what's the contrast? Now, the sacred cows that we make are sacred cows that only wound, that only bring death. They create visions, they create fear, but they actually are not sources of life. Now, this is why the magicians, if you think back to the story of the Exodus, this is why the Egyptians are such essential characters to that story. If you remember back in the story, the magicians do some of the same miracles that Moses does. They turn the Nile into blood, they create a snake, they can do some of this stuff. But what they cannot do is they cannot change things back. In other words, they can introduce the chaos into nature, but they can't control the nature. They couldn't end nature, this chaos. In other words, they cannot create. And this is exactly what our sacred cows do. Once you set something up as sacred, and once your motivated ignorance kicks in, it's pretty hard to stop and to change what you think is sacred. That's why there's so much division in our politics. Once you bow down to something, it's pretty hard to stand back up. And once you make a thing sacred, it enslaves you. And then here is the difference. I bring death and I give life. I wound and I heal. This God is not a sacred cow. This God is not bound by the rules of life and death. We have this world that we think of completely in terms of life and death. This God is not bound by those two oppositions. This God is Lord of life and death. He is the source of both, outside of both, which means he is beyond both. In other words, he's even beyond sacredness. God kind of stands above the whole thing, a creator who is not a creature, a God who is no God. This means that, in a certain way, God is not sacred. In kind of a weird way, God is actually beyond sacredness. He's beyond that way of relating to us, to humanity. While sacred cows and idols enslave us, God frees us. Now, one of the interesting things about this phrase, I bring death and I give life, I wound and I heal, was this phrase was used by the early rabbis as evidence for the resurrection. I'm not sure if you're aware, but first of all, Jews believe in resurrection. Hopefully you're aware of that. Second of all, there was discussion whether resurrection was true. And there's a group, if you remember in the Gospels, the Sadducees, who did not believe in resurrection, but they weren't the only group. So the early rabbis had these discussions, people arguing that the resurrection was not in Moses, the books of Moses. And this is one of the places where they argued there is the resurrection. And what's even more interesting to my mind is how this relates to the story of Jesus appearing to his disciples, especially in John 20. Now remember that when Jesus appeared to his disciples, one of the things that he did was to show his wounds. You know, remember these stories, right? Now, the question is, why does he still have his wounds? In the resurrection life, we're still going to have scars? We're still going to have all these problems? I mean, that seems like a weird thing, right? But the purpose was to show that the resurrection life for Jesus was not simply a cancellation of death, but that resurrection is a type of life beyond life and death. It's life on a different plane. Life that shows that this is the same man whose death was a part of his story, whose death and his interment in a grave was a part of his life story. And now his life story is on a different plane. It is beyond our ideas of life and death. This is why in John's revelation, Jesus is seen as a lamb who was slain, as the risen lamb who was slain. Jesus is never seen except as the crucified and risen Lord. And so you see that both the song, as this song, and the resurrection agree. God is beyond life and death, because God controls both life and death. And this means a very important fact, that we are free to confess. The problem is sacred cows make confession virtually impossible. After all, I mean, if you think about this, if you confess, you have violated that particular sacredness, what happens? In most instances, you get excommunicated. You get thrown out of the tribe. You become a scapegoat. This happens in political sphere. This is one of the reasons why there's and the left and the right have these echo chambers. I don't remember if you guys heard the story of David Frum, who was one of Bush's speechwriters, who said after the health care law got passed that the Republicans missed a big opportunity to affect something change. And he got sacked from a conservative organization that he worked for. And he was kind of thrown out as a kind of a pariah. And this stuff happens often. This is why there's this kind of orthodoxy on both sides that people don't talk about. That's what sacred cows do. They create division and they excommunicate people. But we now live with a God who is able to handle this kind of confession. God is not like our sacred cows, which are unmerciful if we violate them. The Song of Moses was almost an institutionalization, you know, like a making it part of the permanent feature of what biblical faith is, that corporate confession is a practice that we should do a lot. And this is the reason why we do it at this church. This is the reason why corporate confession is something that is very, very important, because it starts to focus us on thinking about how we create sacred things and how we are wrong. And doesn't this make sense in a way? I mean, isn't the resurrection all about the forgiving presence of God? Why else do we praise God for raising Jesus from the grave if not that condemnation does not have the last word in our lives? So tonight I want you to take this home and kind of keep this text with you and let us learn how to sing this song. Let us not be afraid of accusing ourselves when we have erred. Let us remember that this God is beyond life and death. This God is not a sacred cow, but the very source of everything that is. Therefore, there is nothing that we can do, nothing that we can admit that will diminish our Lord. And there is no sacred cow that we can create to compete. Let us pray.